We're live. It is the 10th of January 2025, another episode of the show. And I think the biggest story this week that we're going to have to weigh in on, I think, with some analysis, is the developing kind of pressure that is being placed now on the British government to do a proper inquiry into the Pakistani rape gangs, where estimates vary, and that's part of why they want to do an inquiry. Estimates vary between hundreds of thousands up into the millions as to how many girls, majority of them underage, were basically gang raped by these gangs. And it's not just gang rape, like one-off gang rapes. A lot of them were literally enslaved, like enslaved, as not as prostitutes, really, because they weren't getting paid, I don't think. Like, just enslaved as sex slaves, basically. Girls as young as like 10, 11, 12 years old, injected with heroin in many cases, to also then make them dependent. Just horrific stuff. I don't even want to go into all the details, of what's come out, because it's just horrific stuff.
Basically Taken, right? Taken with Liam Neeson, that movie, except for 10-year-olds in England.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember what happened in Taken. I didn't really pay attention 8 years ago when I watched it, but yeah,
And
it
the
probably is
kidnappers
more.
are even more brown. They're not Albanians, they're Pakistanis.
Yeah. So anyway, so that is the big story. We talked about it a little bit last week because it was already a developing story last week, but it's become an even bigger story. Obviously, Elon Musk has been championing the story. And Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister of Britain, is heavily implicated because he was one of the high-ranking police officials at the time when this was at its peak. It's still going on, but when it was at its peak in the like late 2000s and the early 2010s, he was one of the high-ranking police traitors that conspired to cover it up, basically, and prevent justice from being delivered, which still hasn't been delivered to this day. Some of them got jail sentences, but nothing like the justice that they deserve. So that's the situation. It's obviously being weaponized against the current Labour government in Britain, which is not doing very well in the polls. It's becoming fueled as a mainstream political issue, largely because of Elon Musk and then basically the broad English-speaking right wing coalescing around that, amplifying these concerns, and it's gone crazy on Twitter, and therefore it's becoming a mainstream media story as well. And it all kind of came to a head where a reform MP, not Farage, a different one, basically demanded an inquiry, put it to a vote, and all the Labour Party, who are obviously in government at the moment, all voted against it to prevent an inquiry from happening, which is then only kind of intensified the scandal. Why don't they want to do an inquiry? They're obviously trying to protect themselves, because probably not just Starmer, but probably other people in the Labour Party are also implicated. Reform is surging in the polls as a result. And it's interesting to see how this is affecting British politics. But then it's also created like a larger discussion on the dissident right as to how we should be approaching this. Our perspective is quite clear. When nationalists, white identitarians, they've been talking about this issue since the 2000s. And it's been a largely suppressed issue in the media, in Britain and elsewhere, because a lot of things have come out, if you've studied up on the issue, where it was like literal, like racially motivated, where they were targeting white girls as Pakistanis, using slurs while they were raping the girls and so on. And it was covered up because they're Pakistani by an anti-white government to protect multiculturalism. So these, hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of British girls were literally sacrificed on the altar of multiculturalism by this traitorous establishment that rules over Britain. So this is probably the worst crime, I would say, that's been committed against our people in recent memory. I can't think of anything more reprehensible in scale.
With the not level, since like, the Second World War, for sure.
Yeah.
There's so, nothing like this since the Second World War. This is, since the rape of Berlin and the bombing of Dresden, this is probably the worst crime.
Yeah, the scale is insane. I mean, people could crunch numbers about all the crimes committed against whites by blacks in America, but yeah, it doesn't really matter. The point is that the scale is insane. And obviously the complicity of the establishment is even more disgusting. Many of them white, obviously. So that's the issue. And then a broader discussion has now broken out because the question is, well, what's Elon Musk's motivations in advancing the story? You know, I said last week, seems kind of convenient that he pivots to this after getting absolutely roasted on the H-1B Indian issue. You know, he's jumped to an issue now that, you know, the broad identitarian right can't help but sympathize with him on. And he's like restoring his reputation somewhat after getting absolutely trashed on the timeline from Christmas to New Year, basically, over his endorsement of, you know, expanding legal immigration into America. So that's obviously one aspect of it. But I think a deeper aspect of it as well is that there was talk about Elon Musk giving £100 million or $100 million, I can't remember which currency was denominated in, donation to the Reform Party that was proposed. The Reform Party leadership is scheduled to meet personally with Elon Musk in, I think, the coming weeks. It was being reported in the media to discuss him, like, coming in and backing the party. So Elon Musk he also did a Twitter space today with Alice Weidel from the Alternative for Deutschland Party. So obviously Elon Musk is not just content with involving himself in American politics. Obviously he was a massive supporter of Donald Trump and is Donald Trump's right-hand man, it seems like now, and gave Trump hundreds of millions of dollars to get elected and campaign for Trump. But now he's looking to insinuate himself into British and German politics. So that's interesting, and people don't trust him for obvious reasons, what his motivations are behind this. But nevertheless, the general consensus on the right, with few exceptions, is that that it's a good thing that attention is being brought to this issue, whatever his particular motivations are. And we've been championing this issue for 2 decades, and finally it's getting mainstreamed. Finally, mainstream political pressure is building up around the issue, and it provides at least some hope that justice can be served. But more importantly, because we don't put a lot of faith probably in the system and even in something like the Reform Party to do what is necessary, at the very least, it can raise the consciousness of the people and, focus the political conversation around, you know, the crimes that have been committed against the English nation, against white people, onto the issues that really matter, issues around immigration, remigration, deportation. You know, is it possible to, like, should we be sharing a society with Pakistanis? No. Should we be sharing a society with, you know, Muslims? No. Should we be sharing a society with non-whites? No. So that discussion is now, you know, being greased up to take place, and I think that's a great thing. But more importantly, justice needs to be served for our people. Like, this is my view. Every single individual involved needs to be executed. Anything less than that is completely unsatisfactory. You don't let foreigners waltz into your country, mass gang rape and sexually enslave hundreds of thousands or millions of your own girls, and they get to keep breathing. That's just unacceptable. And every single traitor in the government and everyone else complicit in it, all their heads need to roll. There's no crime, there's no punishment other than execution, which is justified for these crimes. Like, the crimes are too crazy in scale. And the honor of the Anglo-Saxon people and the English nation can't be restored until justice is served. And so that's a non-negotiable position in my view, regardless of any political context that we have to hold to. And people are getting more angry about it, and good. People aren't angry enough. They need to get even more angry about it than they already are, because, you know, we as Anglo-Saxons are in a state of dishonor until this is actually restored. And that's why I called the stream Blood and Honor. It isn't just a slogan, because this goes deeper than political pragmatism in my view. When a crime of this scale is committed against your people, it is literally a matter of honor. And I think it goes a long way to saying why our people are in the state that we're in, that something like this was done to us and it's been taken on the chin and not enough has been done to rectify the situation, not even close. We've basically been cucked as a people by this event. And until it gets resolved, like, we're in a spiritual state of fallenness. But anyway, I've spoken for a while, so I'll throw it to you guys, but I just wanted to give my view on the situation.
First of all, I'd like to say that capital punishment is not even an extreme position. Mass executions is actually completely pragmatic. It's completely reasonable. It's the common sense approach, and it's the policy that any replacement government should have to deal with what's happened. And an example that I'll give is, in Australia, most of our trading partners are in Asia, and basically every single one of our trading partners has capital punishment for crimes that we consider minor, like drug dealing. Most of our Asian trading partners kill drug dealers. They just execute them. I know in Vietnam recently they executed a CEO that stole, I don't know, like a couple million dollars, or it was a large amount of money, but that wasn't even drug dealing. That was just mass theft, like a large scale theft, and they executed her. So the people that the Australian government associate with, the foreign nations we associate with, are regularly executing people, especially China. They're regularly executing people for crimes not even 1/1,000,000% as severe as what's happened in the UK. So the most absolutely common sense, pragmatic approach to policy change that needs to occur is mass executions. We need mass executions in the UK for every single traitor and every single one of these people that has been part of the cover-up as well. Covering up these crimes is, in my opinion, implicit, it's implication of the crime itself. And the fact that anyone that would want to cover up a crime like this, to me, makes it very obvious that they are part of it. And the second thing that I'll say is, because I think mass executions is absolutely common sense and it's absolutely what needs to happen in the UK. The second thing is, to me, this scandal, it shouldn't even be called a scandal. It's so beyond a scandal. I don't even have the word to describe what this is. This Holocaust, this crime against white people, against Anglo-Saxon people, at a scale a mass scale of potentially over 1 million young girls, some of which are underage. This, to me, is the executioner's axe on the whole liberal democratic system in the United Kingdom. This is the executioner's axe. And what I mean by that is, there's a lot of people that think that we just need a change in political party, or we just need a change in the people that lead the political party, and that we just vote for the right guy and we tick the right box, and the liberal democracy can just fix itself. But this is not the case. This is not a box tick away. This is not a vote away. That's actually not going to solve the problem. This is the executioner's axe on the entire liberal democratic system. And the reason for that is because it wasn't just the politicians that are in on it. It wasn't just the judges. It wasn't just the police. It wasn't just the social workers. It was also the media. The media covered it up as well and are continuing to run a smear campaign and a cover campaign, a smoke and mirrors campaign to cover up their involvement in these crimes. So what do you do? What box do you tick to change basically almost every single elected official? What box do you tick to change every single senior police officer? What box do you tick to change basically every single judge? What box do you tick to change the entire media establishment? And on top of that, get justice for everything that's happened and deport tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of the Pakistani community that are actively involved in these crimes, and potentially millions that are inactively involved in helping support and cover up these crimes, because there's a whole range of stories where they've done this. So what we're talking about is mass executions, mass deportations. We're talking about regime change of the entire liberal democratic system. We're talking about holding accountable the entire media establishment, most of the courts, most of the senior police officers, if not all of them, in every region where this occurred. And to me, as I said, this is the executioner's axe. This one momentous crime against us, this one momentous crime against white women, against white children, is in itself the most powerful card or the most powerful symbol that we need to have the strength to follow through with in order to create the world that we deserve to live in as white people, as Anglo-Saxon people, and as English people.
I would usually play devil's advocate to some extent and say, well, what's the other side of the story? But in this case, there isn't another side of the story. These things happened. The cover-up is real. The complicit role played by the politicians, media officials, and political bureaucrats of various kinds, it's all real. I can't really dispute it. I've been reading about it for the past week or two. And I'd read about it a couple of years ago as well, or when it was first coming to light to some extent. But I've got a couple of thoughts on it. First of all, I find it difficult to read about the details of the crimes. I prefer not to do it. Even Elon Musk shared an excerpt from one of the court documents where it was described what happened to one of the victims who was, I believe, 12 years old, a 12-year-old girl. And I don't think it's good for the spirit to be reading all of the details about what you need to understand what happened, but I think discussing consequences for those involved and spending most of your time thinking about solutions and consequences rather than reading about the details of the crimes themselves, it's better for the spirit because it makes you very angry when you read about what these people have been doing to young British girls. It compresses the soul. It crushes you internally because you're angry, but you can't do anything with that anger. And there's only so long you can remain in that state of feeling before you become, as I said, internally compressed. I think that may even be the point. Maybe that's part of the reason they do this to young girls. It's part of the reason they did it in the first place. It's some sort of spiritual terrorism. It's not just actual terrorism. It's not just physical terrorism. It terrorizes the national spirit of the people across the land when they find out about it too. I think they have this concept called rape jihad, the Muslims, don't they? And it happens everywhere they go. Wherever they go, they're raping people who aren't like them. And I think that's why the majority of Greece, even today, have darker features where they previously were from the north. Most Greeks know that too. I think if you still go to northern Greece, you can find Greeks with blonde hair. But the second thing that comes to mind is how to tie all of these problems into a single category, because what is the issue right now? Is it Pakistani immigrants? Is it Africans? Is it all immigrants? Is it the politicians? Is it the Muslims? Is it the Jewish people lobbying all the politicians, and are they behind it all? So I think it's wise to remember that, you know, as Hitler writes in Mein Kampf, that it belongs to the leader of genius to tie many different problems, enemies into a single category. So what do you think? How do we do that? What's the single category, the single problem that we're faced with, regardless of all the, you know, different crimes, immigrants, and whatever they're getting up to? How do we summarize our enemy?
Well, the enemy clearly is everyone that cares more about the feelings of brown people than white girls getting raped. And that's the enemy, and every single one of them needs to be punished. They need to be hunted down, investigated, and punished. And the real question is, who will judge the judges, and who will police the police when they're all in on it?
Yeah, I mean, that's this something on this scale to have occurred, only like a revolutionary response is going to fix it. Like, the rot is clearly way too deep for this to have occurred and been allowed to go on for this long. And I said on Twitter today, and I've given this take before, you know, people were saying, oh, well, Elon Musk is just trying to use this, or other elements are just trying to use this to install reform at the next election in Britain over the Labour Party. And I think that is the case. And so apparently we're just playing into the op. And I said, well, I'm not playing into the op. You know, I'm a national socialist. I'm not a Reform Party voter. I'm not a conservative. And I don't believe that the Reform Party is capable of fixing these problems or even willing to fix these problems. But having said that, that doesn't mean that I'm going to stop talking about it just because they've started talking about it. When conservatives or Jews start saying things that sound like what we're saying, we don't shut up. That shows that our the strength of our moral argument is so potent that they can't even resist trying to play into it and trying to play into our sensibilities, because our sensibilities resonate with the people. The issues that we are raising are actually important and valuable and make people angry and mobilize people behind supporting particular political movements. That shows political strength behind our ideas and behind our perspective. And so that's what's going to happen. When you have political strength behind your perspective, other groups are going to try and adopt your positions to try and use that to their advantage. That's just what happens in politics. But if they get into power, if the Reform Party get into power, they will not fix the problem. And so our criticism of the conservatives, and they're just another conservative party, Nigel Farage says it himself, we're just real conservatives, unlike the Tories, you know, then our criticism will become even more potent, because if they get in power and this issue still isn't fixed and justice still isn't done and the immigrants are still coming in and they're not being deported, then we can say, hey, look, these people can't solve your problems, white man. You need a more radical solution. And there won't be a kind of cope where, oh, but, you know, you guys are really unoptical and extreme and, you know, the Reform Party is able to get votes and they're established and they have the support of the people. So we're going to back that instead of backing you, because we might get 80% of what we want than 100%, but it's more viable. It's an easier path to victory. When they see that it's a path to nowhere, I think that oblivion, that reality check, will make our job easier, not harder. A lot of people disagree with me and think that it will placate the masses and it'll, you know, dissipate our radical energy or something. I don't think that's going to be the case. And I think with Trump just winning the election in America, I think the next 4 years are going to be 4 years of radicalization. A lot of people put a lot of hope in this. Their hopes are going to get dashed. They're going to be disappointed and they're going to get angry. And they're going to look for a more radical politics, and we're going to be there with the answers. And I think we're going to grow. The solution is building up independent pro-white organizations and institutions to represent our viewpoint without compromise, whether it be compromise from Jewish donors or compromise ideologically. And our uncompromising approach is going to become more popular, not less popular, more valid, not less valid, as this kind of populist conservative, movement sweeps across the Western world and gains a bunch of political power and ultimately disappoints in the ways that we can all see the signs of if you're really paying attention closely. So I think we need to stay strong on these issues, keep pushing our narrative forward without compromising whatsoever, and we'll be vindicated through time. You know, people say, oh, Joel, you know, or Tom or whatever, you shouldn't be calling for mass executions. That's bad optics. No. It's not bad optics. It's great optics. Killing rapists, child rapists, foreign child rapists, enemy invader foreign child rapists is great optics, actually. That's actually some of the best optics possible. Bad optics is being a cuck little bitch who says anything else. That's the only response. So extreme things are being done to our people. An extreme solution is required. You know, radically horrible things are being done to our people. A radical solution is required. This is not a space that conservatism can fill So I think we're in a great position to keep growing. The fact that pro-white issues, in the mainstream discourse and that, you know, major figures, major power brokers in politics are having to play to our concerns more and more and more, in order to like legitimate themselves and that they're being weaponized, is an objectively good thing, even if we don't trust their particular agenda. And those two things can be disentangled. And I saw an argument break out on Twitter and then on Telegram between Nick Fuentes and Keith Woods about this, because Elon Musk retweeted Keith Woods a few times talking about, you know, the ethnic breakdown of gang rapists and in different European countries and things like that, and other issues like racial hate crimes against children in Scotland, I think, was one of them that Elon retweeted. But he retweeted a bunch of Keith Woods posts, right? And an argument broke out because Keith Woods gave Elon some credit, saying, you know, like Elon deserves some credit for bringing attention to these issues. And I agree with Fuentes that we don't really need to give any credit to Elon because he clearly has his own political agenda. But at the same time, Fuentes got very angry at Keith Woods and basically implied that by talking about Pakistani rape gangs, by amplifying this issue at a time where Elon Musk is amplifying it, that somehow we're taking the bait, quote unquote, and we're playing into the hands of the Zionists who are trying to make us hate Muslims, to redirect
our energy. Sounds like the words of someone who didn't get retweeted.
Yeah, there obviously is a lot of personal animosity that Fuentes has towards Keith that really came out. If you read the Telegram posts, you know, it seemed like basically like a narcissistic mental breakdown where he was like, oh, Keith Woods didn't talk enough about the Groiper accounts that Elon Musk banned last week, and that's disloyal or something. Like, he's under some obligation to post about it more than once or twice or something. I actually listened to a Twitter space with that Adrian Dittman guy when Keith Woods argued with him about the issue of immigration and some other things back when the last week of last year, where everything was kind of all the discussion on Twitter was about H-1B visas and Indian immigration and things like that. And people think Adrian Dittman is Elon Musk. I'm not sure if he is or he isn't, but I think probably he isn't, but he kind of sounds like him though, but whatever. They were having a debate in this Twitter space, and Keith spent like an hour talking about how all the Groiper accounts are being banned and how this is contrary to free speech and blah, blah, blah. So it was a bit of a weird move by Fuentes, considering Keith Woods has been one of his like closest allies and friends for so long, and now he's, you know, deciding to turn on him. So it definitely is motivated by mental illness and so on. But putting that to one side, on the issue itself, the fact that Elon Musk is retweeting Keith Woods or using these talking points or whatever, like, what are we taking the bait on exactly? We've been talking about this for 2 decades, basically, as a movement. Now it's being weaponized to destroy the Keir Starmer Labour government by Elon Musk and the Reform Party or something. Okay, fuck Keir Starmer. Like, who cares if they overthrow the Labour government? Like, is the Reform... Like, I don't think the Reform government is the solution, but are they going to be worse than the Labour government? The Labour government that was locking up, you know, anti-immigration protesters for multi-year sentences over, like, absolute nothing burgers mid-last year, run by an individual who literally covered up Pakistani rape gangs, you know, who's got a Jewish wife and was literally installed as the leader of the Labour Party in a coup against Jeremy Corbyn because Jeremy Corbyn was pro-Palestine. And they installed Keir Starmer to run the Labour Party because he would play ball with Israel. So it's like the Jews already have their guy in charge. Like, it's not like the Jews are worried about the Labour government and they're really undermining the Jewish agenda. So they're like getting white people whipped up into a rage around Muslims to like overthrow a government they don't like. It's heads, you win, tails, they lose on both issues for them.
You said Elon has his own political agenda. What is Elon's political agenda?
Elon Musk's political agenda. Well, there's a few things. Like, number one, I mean, we've talked about it on the show extensively, like I think before, but I think Elon Musk...
How would you summarize it?
Well, Elon Musk is fundamentally concerned with, obviously, like, he's all about tech, but a lot of his tech is key tech pertaining to US geopolitical power. And he's a key ally of the America. He's one of the elites of America. He's one of the most powerful people in America. He's the richest man in America on paper. And, you know, SpaceX is vital to American national security.
All his companies are.
Yeah, but pretty much all of his companies are to different degrees.
He's like a libertarian that's invested in a change of guard to protect, like, the Department of Defense or, like, you know, the American big business and the corporation that it's attached to. So it's like a corporate, it's like a East India Company 2.0. He's like a libertarian, neo-futurist East India Company overlord oligarch. So yeah, you understand, correct. Gumbo diplomacy, like East India.
Oh, I like that.
It's a good picture. You know what East India Company is, Blair? It's like the British basically mutated into a corporation. And that's basically what America's done since World War II. America is a giant corporation. America is Wall Street. And it's big business. It's the Department of Defense. It's, you know, as of the last 20 years, or at least the last 10 years, one big change that has occurred in America is the top 20 companies have gone from big oil companies, big arms manufacturing companies, basically to tech. Like tech is the new like Chevron, you know what I mean? Like tech is the new oil. Like if we look at like the invasion of Iraq and the destabilization of the Middle East and all these things, America was on board with these things primarily because its biggest corporations, Wall Street, its biggest shareholders, its biggest partners were on board with it so that they could make more profits and they could control more of the global
economy. Well, it was for Israel.
Yeah, it was, but that's where you've got, again, like people talk about, like you hear people all the time blame the British for bringing the Rothschilds to power. And it's partly true. Like the British allied with the Rothschilds, the East India Company and the Crown, you know, allowed the Jews to gain this financial power. Likewise, the war in Iraq was for Israel, but it's where you see a Judeo-American alliance come to fruition in terms of raw money and raw special interests working together. And so what you have now is a change in that guard where Chevron and the big defense companies are still powerful, but you've got people like Musk that are even more powerful. Again, you've got Zuckerberg, Musk, Bezos, you know, you've got these kind of tech adjacent companies and a new type of Department of Defense that's coming out, which is, you know, everything that Musk is doing, like Tesla, for example, if America ran out of oil, had oil supply issues, he would be looking at how to basically run the military off solar and battery and stuff like that. So that's really what he is. And then his personal social political views are obviously more libertarian aligned. He's like your average libertarian, really.
Yeah, I think that's all true. But also, he's so aligned with the American empire with all these investments. And the American empire is basically sabotaging itself with excess wokeness, quote unquote, you know, with excess leftism, which is an ideological program that isn't purely like a rational calculation of what's in the interests of the American elite. Like it was funded into an existence by them because it served some purposes. It helped like break down white power, you know, which benefited like, you know, Jewish interests and like prevented the rise of fascism or national socialism. You know, it also was used in Europe during the Cold War to create a left wing that was like distinct from the Soviet Union by creating an independent Western left wing that had more like cultural and identitarian concerns rather than being like Bolshevik or whatever. And so those elements are at play, but there's a recognition that basically like left-wing ideology has become so extreme that it's got to the point now where it's sabotaging the capacity for the US military to function correctly, and it's sabotaging the capacity for the US economy to function correctly, and so on. Like if you want to have the best tech in the world, you need white men in lab coats working on building it. And if you have DEI programs going out of control, well, there's no young white men that are going to be filling those positions anymore because they've been systematically, you know, discriminated against and prevented from, you know, going to the top universities and developing those skills and so on. And also the US military, if it's full of trannies and like women in combat roles and like, you know, basically you create this sense that like the entire US government is against patriotic white people, so they don't want to sign up to the military anymore and fight for it. Well, and the US military is not going to be completely like debilitated in a genuine combat scenario against like, you know, the Chinese Russian axis, if they have any meaningful engagements. So there's a certain realism that elements of the American elite have had to come to, which Musk is spearheading to try and take the edge off the wokeness, take the edge off the DEI, take the boot somewhat off the neck of white people. Not completely. He's not a white nationalist. But, you know, basically to bring things back to the center, to restabilize the political system and make the empire more functional again. so that it's capable of developing the technology and standing up to its geopolitical enemies, so that Musk can achieve his aspirations of using America as a launching pad to build AI and to go to Mars, and you know, all of these like techno futurist fantasies that he has, which will be foreclosed if you have, you know, black lasquishes, you know, running the American government, and you know, a bunch of like trans Latinos on the front lines trying to like fight China or something. So obviously I'm being somewhat like, you know, silly in how I'm describing that, but that's, I think generally like the self-awareness that has come in that Musk is spearheading, but many elements of the American elite are feeling like that. And that's why there's this pervasive sense that wokeness is getting, has reached its peak and is being reversed. And also all of this is happening while Israel has been under existential threat. The left wing, because of how strong left wing ideology has become and how incompatible it is with Zionism as like a Western imperialist, you know, ethno state that oppresses brown people or whatever. It's like, well, you know, if you're going to build a whole society around national socialism being bad, yeah, you can use like the Holocaust and Jewish victimhood to try and carve out the exception to allow Jewish people to have national socialism, but no one else. And that will work for a while, but eventually, you know, the Golem attacks, its, you know, creator, you know, Frankenstein, Frankenstein's monster attacks Frankenstein, you know? So that is now happening with the left. And so there's a realism with the Zionist elite saying, well, you know, we probably want to like put the conservatives back in power and like beef up American power projection so we can confront China, Israel's enemies. You know, there's obviously an active war happening with Russia in Eastern Europe. The American empire has never been under such existential threat since the Cold War ended. Israel hasn't been under such existential threat in decades. And so all of this is coalescing into this primarily Jewish elite, as Elon Musk says, whether there's some speculation that he is part Jewish. I can't confirm it. I suspect it, but I can't confirm it. But what you can confirm is his remarks saying that he said that more than half of his friends are Jewish. He's aspirationally Jewish. And you can see that he's very much aligned with Zionists and with Jews. So as is Trump, as is the Reform Party, as is the element of the Alternative for Deutschland Party, which Musk is aligning himself with, the faction led by Alice Weidel. So you can see this coalescence of this like national conservative Zionist populism, and a lot of elite interests, like Elon Musk co-investor in PayPal, which was what got both of these guys kind of started. Peter Thiel, who also was an early investor in Facebook, which is a U.S. Defense Department project, and is now the biggest investor in Palantir, which is the number one software contractor to the U.S. Defense Department. You know, you can see his interests, his funding is also very much aligned with Elon Musk's, very much involved on the American right, the Trumpist right, and so on. And so you can see a lot of these interests coalescing around this kind of imperial realism, let's say, and also a recognition that whites have been beat down and have been discriminated against and non-represented so much by recent politics that if you throw whites a few bones, you've got a massive voter demographic there that you can then use to wield against the left-wing establishment. So that they can try and course correct the empire. So that's obviously, I think, what Musk is trying to do. And people point that out and say, well, is that really in our interests? And that's a very interesting debate. Would it be better for left-wing retardation to go like full steam ahead and the empire to like just disintegrate underneath its authority? Or would it be better to have a more moderate empire that becomes more functional, that gives whites more rights, more dignity, but maybe wins back their support to the system? Now, my argument is, I think actually that would be better because I don't think that they can actually fix a lot of the key problems that we're identifying here. It would empower whites, it would give whites a sense of political power again, gives us some free speech, enables us to organize somewhat, and then you have the disappointment of the failure of this faction to actually deliver. They'll probably try and mobilize us to fight stupid wars that will end up becoming massively unpopular. Like if they're stupid enough to invade Iran, nothing could do more for anti-Semitism than the U.S. government under Jewish control being hysterical and ridiculous enough to try and invade Iran. If they do that, like, there'll be pogroms against Jews by the end of that decade, like serious pogroms across the West, because, I mean, that'll just be an obvious Jewish war for no reason, and it'll be a total disaster. So, you know, we'll see what direction that they go with things, but I think ultimately the disappointment of their success will be more radicalizing than just this kind of like slow degradation under this left-wing tyranny where people are just so demoralized. It feels so hopeless. And the government's only priority is just preventing whites from having any organization at all while everything crumbles around us, this kind of anarcho-tyranny. I think that's actually a harder position to fight our way out of. Some people disagree. They say, oh, actually, that's better. It'll alienate whites more. It'll radicalize whites more. But insofar as it's been happening over the last decade or two, I haven't really been seeing a lot of that, to be honest. So I don't know
whether it's slow or whether it's fast, we'll make a way either way. But what do you think, Blair? What do you think Musk, because you're more of a psychological analyst, what do you think of Musk's motivations?
He wants to be a cool billionaire. He wants to be the edgy, cool billionaire that the little people like. You know, he wants the support of the little people in America, and he wants to be cool. He doesn't want to go with the flow, or he at least wants to appear to not be going with the flow. That's why he, you know, he still sits in the ivory tower, but he, you know, speaks to the little people. He'll respond to your comment. He'll reshare your post, even if you're some nobody with 5,000 Twitter followers. You know, so I think he's trying to drum up that sort of average working Joe support. But I can't really see beyond that. I don't spend enough time on X. I'd like to spend more time on there because I can see that there's a great deal of nuance, there's a great deal of discussion, and a lot of influence happens through the community, to the community through X at the moment. To me, it's still a non-world. It's still a false reality, and I remind myself of that. But we do still need to participate in it because it's a reality that still has an impact on the psyche of the everyday person. But that's all I can say about Musk personally. I could think a little bit more on it and give you an expansion of my take there. But I was thinking, Joel said on a few times there, he referenced left-wing ideology. Do you think modern leftism is actually an ideology? Is it an ideology? Because to me, it just seems like anti-white subversion or general anti-national terrorism. I mean, is it actually a structured ideology, or is it just an anti-national terror campaign? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's a reasonable assessment. But you could say that itself, like anti-whiteism, is itself an ideology, you know, built around this idea that colonialism and whites essentially building the entire modern world and dragging the rest of the world into it is some grand historical crime that we need to basically be we have to commit collective suicide as restitution for. And then like left-wing ideologues are like high priests of this secular religion to like mediate that process so that we can assuage ourselves of the guilt of being better than brown people at running civilization.
Further on Musk, he's a moon-faced Cancerian and he's quite emotional. He gets pissed off. Have you noticed in some of his replies? Yeah. He attacks people. Yeah. He gets seriously worked up. And that goes to show he's a sensitive creature, but that goes to show he's going to be easily pulled in certain directions by people who know how to pull people in directions through feeling. So he's an interesting cat. He's relatively new on the scene, I think, when it comes to – well, I don't know. I won't say that, actually. Yeah. I don't know enough. He's new.
Yeah. Yeah. Him being a big political player is, a more recent development. He's been around for a while, but he was more aloof in the past when it came to politics.
He's flexing his muscle now. He sees his, like – he's a potential kind of almost like a the alliance that he has with this new center, this mega camp and the Musk Joe Rogan bros, and you can see this kind of cool libertarian, new right, common sense, anti-woke. He's aligning with AFD, he's aligning with MAGA, he's aligning with Reform. You can see that he is a big part of the changing of the guard and that he's trying to be like a mover and a shaker and he's not afraid to flex his muscle. And what the left are calling it is election interference, which is pretty funny. And then he's calling it out and he's saying, well, hang on a minute. You guys were interfering in the election. I'm just doing what you guys were doing.
All politics is election interference. Everyone's interfering with the election every time they speak.
Yes. It's like, exactly. So he's playing the same game that they're playing. So that's respectable.
He's just a George Soros of the right, you know, like he's just
I don't know. He definitely feels like he's part of right-wing online culture, though, part of meme culture, because you could tell he was personally hurt by the lack of support or the criticism he received over the H-1B visas. Mm. Like, he was personally dissatisfied with that. You could tell by his remarks and how he lashed out at a few people. It's like his own friends turned on him, or what he thought were his own friends were turning on him, and he responded like that. So that was interesting to observe too.
Well, he's definitely a narcissist, and he's very sensitive about his public image, because I think Sam Hyde pointed this out in his excellent video that pretty much everyone must have seen probably by now, because it was extremely viral, to Elon Musk about that whole H-1B Indian scandal, where he said, like, Elon, you want to be the cool billionaire? You want everyone to like you? If you didn't, we wouldn't know about you. You'd be like the other billionaires that are just kind of in the background and they do an interview on CNN once a year and no one really gives a fuck about them. But you want us to like you because you're here trying to make us like you every single day. So that means you have to do things. You have to not fuck us over. You have to win us over. You have to make concessions to us. Like, it doesn't, you can't just demand that we like you. That's not how it works. And I thought that was an interesting tactic by Sam Hyde, because Elon would have seen that for sure. But I think Elon's probably playing a deeper game of 5D chess.
West Sydney talking about him, right? He's going to doing a good job at remaining in the, well, basically whatever he talks about, or whatever he brings up on X becomes the major political talking point across the world within a couple of days. He's steering the conversation. So we're talking about him right now still. So.
Well, absolutely. Well, we're only on this website because he bought it and let us all come back onto it. And then now we can stream on it after being banned from YouTube. It's like
the main difference between him and Soros is that Soros at least gave Soros bucks to all the radical left-wing organizations like Femin and Antifa, like all Antifa affiliate organizations. Whereas Musk, he gives us a voice, which is probably worth more at this time. In order for us to build up our audience and build up our support and build up our membership, that's more important than money. These other organizations, they're out of touch and they're never going to make any significant change. They're always going to be sort of stuck as little activists. If you know what Femin is, it's like a feminazi organization that basically just does all the weird protests where they like strip naked and put their tits out and write dumb messages on their chests. That's Femin, and George Soros personally funds that. Like, that's a fact. That whole organization is like 30 prostitutes funded funded for their activities.
But you don't need as much when you're telling the truth. You need more resources when you're talking shit, trying to subvert. You need a lot more propaganda, a lot more money thrown at you. But for us, I think we can do a lot more. We can have a great deal.
We're just a level playing field.
All we need is a voice. All we need is the right of reply, and we win basically. So,
almost every time, yeah.
Yeah, but so it is interesting, however, to see. You know, now the debate on the right is like, well, how should we? What attitude should we have towards him? Like, we don't want to become sycophantic and like just glaze Elon because he's very clearly aligning himself with Jews and with agendas that will, you know, replace us, like supporting Indian immigration and so on, amplifying a lot of anti-white talking points during that debate. So we can't reward that. But then at the same time, you know, there's other things he's doing which are good, like bringing us back to Twitter and, you know, drawing attention to the rape gangs in Britain in such an intense way. And so it's a complicated thing to know exactly what attitude to take towards it. And my view is that we should acknowledge that these things are good. We should probably not personally, I think the hero worship or this kind of like delusion that Elon's our guy and he's going to like, you know, and that he can be appealed to. And if we just like send the right tweet in his replies, he'll realize that Hitler was a good guy or something. I think this is delusional and insane. And a lot of people like are acting like as if that's the case. I'm not accusing anyone in particular, but you know, it seems like that attitude is itself dishonorable. It's like this attitude of disempowerment that like we need some like billionaire to like come in and save us. And obviously if we had a NatSoc billionaire, that would be great. But at the same time, we need to have a perspective of empowerment, of building up our own strength from within rather than looking without for a savior. That's like a loser point of view. You know, if we build up our own strength, we do our own thing, we build our movement, we keep advancing ourselves, we focus on ourselves, we become stronger and stronger and stronger. If outside help comes, they will see that and they will come at the right time. But like being like sycophants, having this, you know, overly optimistic cope attitude, I think this is a real problem because...
the Christians have. The Christians are always waiting for a savior, and that makes them feel like they don't have to do anything because Jesus is going to come back and burn the world anyway, so I don't have to do anything. I just need to sit here and be a good Christian and watch everyone burn. It's, I don't believe in outside help. I don't believe in outside help, you know? I believe everything comes from your own energy, your own efforts. And I think God wants us to help ourselves. God wants us to help ourselves. God will help us if we help ourselves.
It's very Hilarion.
Really?
Yes.
I said the same thing all the time.
It's almost word for it. It's beautiful. You're tapped into the hive mind. But I think that there's a big difference. I'll send you the video. It's great. Hitler basically says, we should just play the video. I don't want to spoil it, but I'll at some point I'll send the video to Joel and maybe we'll finish on it. But I do think that that is a major difference between us and the Groypers and a lot of other people that share the same or similar views to us. They share a similar end goal as us. They obviously have a very different strategy. And a lot of the criticism I personally receive from these accounts is, Tom, you know, you'll never succeed because you're not as smart as Nick. And what Nick does so much better than you is he has powerful friends. And that's what these Groypers say to me all the time. They say, you'll never succeed because you alienate powerful people. Whereas Nick is very good at like attracting powerful people to the movement and basically working out how to work with them in order to grow, you know, what he's doing. But I don't really see anything that Nick is doing. I just see that he just talks into a screen. Although we do that sometimes as well, we're actually building a physical movement of men and of manpower, of communities, and we're actually building these things up. But that is definitely the difference in strategy. And
that's interesting on that, though, Tom, is that that's the opposite of what's happening now. Like now what Fuentes seems to be saying is it's all controlled. He's sounding like the Wignats now. It's all controlled. Yeah. Zion Don, Elon Musk, it's all an op and we have no friends and I'm the only one that's saying this. And it's like this kind of 180.
He is very inconsistent and he flip-flops. Like in the lead up to the Trump election, he said, you know, multiple different things that were completely contradictory and opposing to each other. When he doesn't really predict anything correctly because he always predicts the wrong thing as well. And so that doesn't really count. Like, I remember Blair and I joking about this back in the UPF days. I think Blair was like, oh, we should do two videos predicting everything and then just delete the video that's wrong. And I was like, I don't think that's going to work, Blair. Like, but Nick basically does that and it works, but only for his like sycophantic audience. And so the fact that he's in an argument now with Keith, like I think Keith's done a lot of good work. Obviously, we had our differences collectively with, you know, he was getting a little bit too friendly with the pro-Palestinian crowd, and then he kind of steered back in the right direction, which was nice. But, you know, he rode those waves as he did. But it's interesting to see them in a fight and to see Keith kind of I didn't see how sycophantic Keith was, but there's, I don't think it's like against divine law to ride the waves when they're present. Like if you're out in the surf, it's like, this idea that, well, this has been around for 10 years. So why are you glazing Musk when he brings it up? It's like, well, we're using this opportunity to get this back on the table. And if we don't do it, I think that was, this was the point you made, Joel, if we don't do it, then it's only the Zionist-controlled conservative right that are going to be doing it. And that's even worse. So why would we ignore it when we can be the no, maybe not the dominating force for this wave of outrage, but we can certainly be the ones that are coming at it from the correct reason. If there's three people saying the same thing, but they're saying it for three different reasons, then what you're going to have is an audience that is going to be interested, not based off what you've said, but why you've said it. And I think that that's where we're getting at politically. There's a lot of people calling for different things, calling for similar things, but what's their motivation for calling for it?
No, that's absolutely true. And that's the key point. Like, I've had this argument so many times. People were saying to me, it's amazing how I've completely won this argument and almost no one is making it anymore. No one's come forth and said, hey, you got that one right. I got it wrong. But I was saying a year ago, all this Palestine, Gaza glazing, as soon as the Muslims do something fucked up to us or there's some kind of white Muslim dispute, this whole thing is going to fall apart. And we're going to take our side, they're going to take their side, and this whole alliance is going to break down because they don't fundamentally give a shit about us. And also, the way that you're framing this issue is fundamentally leftist by talking about Jewish supremacy and settler colonialism and all of this. It's just the exact same arguments that are being used against white Australians, white Americans, white Canadians about why our sovereignty is illegitimate and why we don't have any rights to our own countries and why we're evil and we deserve to be replaced. And so the reason why I'm against Israel is very simple. It's because I'm against Jews. I don't give a shit about Palestinians, really. They're not my people. It's not my fucking problem. Good luck to them in their fight against the Jews. I'm not going to be wasting any of my energy pretending that I care about them, because that's what they're all doing. None of these people actually care about Palestine. Maybe some of them are stupid enough to maybe they still have that left-wing egalitarian morality, but everyone is just cynically pretending to care about Palestine. But the Palestinians don't give a shit about us.
I don't think anyone in politics genuinely cares about anything other than themselves and their own interests. It's kind of the nature of politics.
Well, I care about our race. Like, that's what I care about.
Well, that's our interest. Yeah.
So why don't we just be honest about what we care about and be consistent and just have the same takes? You know, I used to play, years ago when I was newer to this, I used to try and be smart and go, but this angle would be what would strategically make more sense on this issue at this time.
You wouldn't have to try too hard to be smart, would you?
What we need to do, trying to be too clever always ends up backfiring because issues, they come, they go, the news cycle is constantly changing, and you're just going to be dragged along with the trends in different directions, constantly reacting. You don't want to be a reactive agent. You want to be an active agent. You want to build, you want to put your... plant your swastika in the sand and build and say, this is what I stand for. These are my principles, and just hold to them. And then year after year, repeat them, build support. And all the support that you build, you will keep because you are not changing. So if you keep kind of going with the wind on different issues, people will drop off. You'll get new supporters, but then you go to the next issue, but they don't agree with you on that issue. They fall away. And you have no consistency, and it's like a revolving door political movement, and it constantly changes name, it constantly changes shape. That is not a winning message. That is not a winning strategy in the long term. You might get temporary benefits, like the people that jumped on the Palestine shilling. They got a bunch of Twitter followers and all the rest of it, but ultimately they did long term damage to their reputations, and you know, now they're having to walk it back or pivot or whatever, and they don't seem as authentic to their followers. Whereas those of us that stayed consistent, people are like, these are men of principle. I trust these men. And your support will be genuine because it's real. You're authentic. You're not constantly playing a strategy. Mm. So that's what my approach has been in recent years. I'm not saying that I was doing this a lot. I didn't really weigh in a lot on the political machinations of the day.
We all did
it. But yeah, everyone does it to an extent. And I realized...
Ed Rock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You've got to have
never going to get caught in hypocrisy. You're never going to get caught in any sort of hypocrisy. You don't have to overthink anything when you are true to the bedrock, when you're true to what your core belief systems are and your motivation for what you're saying is pure. And so obviously a lot of people think that we are irrelevant in the greater political process, but we're the only ones. Well, we have been the most consistent. The system is not consistent. All these kind of center-right and center-left people, they're not consistent. They continuously slime and shift and change their views to suit the agenda at the time. We're the only ones that have stayed entirely consistent because we have a moral framework. And our moral framework is a very simple relationship. Is this good for white people or is it bad for white people? And we just don't change on that. And so any policy or any belief system that we have that might be altered is not because we're changing strategy. It's only because we've gone, well, actually, I thought about this deeper and long term, it's actually better for white people to do it this way. And then any disagreement we have or any change we have on our policy is based around that. But what we never change is our fundamental core system. And that's why we're going to succeed, because a belief system that has a bedrock is always going to beat a belief system that actually isn't based on anything, you know, or just humanitarianism or, you know, anti-colonialism, or because none of their belief systems stand up. They're okay with colonialism. The left are fine with colonialism, and it all just boils down to being anti-white. And then the more they expose themselves for being anti-white, the less white people support them. There's obviously still the freaks and the traitors, but ultimately it's going to, you know, sort the wheat and the chaff out.
And also, we're trying to teach the principle of blood loyalty. We're trying to teach the principle of blood and honor. We're trying to teach white people to have loyalty to whites and dignity as white men, to empower them and empower our race to stand on our own two feet. And our message is simple. We can determine our own destiny if we come together and assert it collectively as a people, as a nation, as a race. And so that's what we must do. And we have to practice what we preach. If you're out there shilling Andrew Tate, the pimp mulatto who pimps, you know, white chicks, you know, for money and made his millions, and then realized there's a bunch of alienated whites, and if he says a whole bunch of our talking points and acts like he cares about us, he can build up this white fan base of alienated young white men. And you go, oh, Andrew Tate, he's got a lot of Twitter followers. He's got a lot of, you know, he's got a lot going for him. So I'm going to glaze Andrew Tate to try and get a little bit of his clout. Well, then you're fundamentally cucked. You're cucking yourself to a fucking pimp mulatto. So you are fundamentally in dishonor. How is that setting an example to white men as to how to have honor and dignity as a people, which is our entire political project here? And I've seen people all over the nationalist movement doing that.
That's why when Jacob and I were first in these talks about what, like, we should have a slogan, that's why I decided on blood and honor as the slogan, because blood alone is just going to continue to dilute if we don't have our honor back.
Yeah, like, I can find...
And to me, it's a divine law. To me, the blood is the divine law. And when you try to focus on, well, what's pragmatically the correct thing to do right now in order to gain the most political power at this exact point in time, or not even political power, but just clout and influence, the problem with that is if you don't have this connection to the divine law, if you don't have this connection to an honor system that protects the blood for the longest amount of time, but not just protecting it, advancing it down the furthest trajectory and the strongest trajectory, then pragmatic decisions will send you off course and you'll get lost in the weeds. You'll get lost in the source.
Your thoughts on this, please?
Right. You can change the way you're delivering the message always. You can deliver the message in a new way, but your principles must remain unshakable, I found. And that's why I've always maintained the same sort of support base I had from the beginning, despite not really always doing a lot, despite biding my time. The same sort of people who have supported me and in the beginning, they're still there now. And I think it's because I never changed my fundamental principles. I never was working for anybody else. I was never taking money from anybody, you know. And all of these things, they affect the purity of your message. They affect the purity of your character. So that's why you have to remain true to yourself, true to what you believe. And it's just have those unshakable principles. You can try new things. You can try new versions of the message, but the principles must remain the same.
Yeah, of course.
What's the big difference between you and Tommy Robinson? Like a lot of people when you first came on the scene were saying, you know, this is like the Australian Tommy Robinson. But the difference between you and Tommy Robinson is that you never changed your principles for money. Like no one, like people came along to Tommy and they bailed him out. Like they gave him a lot of money. They got him on the payroll. And, you know, what is it? Ezra Levant and Rebel Media. And, you know, they didn't bother with you because they knew that you had a foundation. You had a foundation belief system that couldn't be bought. Even if you were playing the game, like they didn't even offer you the job because they knew you would have been playing the game and been, you know, it would have been a power struggle the whole time because you weren't actually going to change your trajectory. Whereas Tommy Robinson
didn't have
that base.
Tommy Robinson was literally funded by a Jewish Zionist in America called Robert Shillman. Shillman.
Really? Yeah, right. When I was in England, Mark knows everybody. Mark Collett. He's talked to anyone who's anyone in England, especially. And he used to talk to Tommy Robinson back in the day. And he said to me, when we were in the car driving to the conference, he said, back in the day, Tommy Robinson couldn't shut up about me. He loved me, right? But then, funnily enough, he got involved with certain people and suddenly he wasn't talking about me anymore. He wasn't talking to Mark anymore. And he went off in a new direction. Obviously, that's that direction
Israel
was pointed out then. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Israel.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I have an announcement. I don't think I've said it. I said it on a solo stream that I was doing. But about a week ago, I had another baby. So that's not super.
Hey, congratulations, man. Congratulations. Yeah. That's awesome. Love it.
So two girls now. So I've copied.
Did it all go smoothly? Natural birth and all that?
Yeah. So we had a natural birth. Well, Beck had a natural birth for the first one. These hands, midwives rocked up late. So it was just the two of us. It took about, I think the first one was about 2 hours 45. From start to finish. And then this one was about half of that. It was about 1 hour 30, maybe even a little bit less. And we didn't even bother with midwives this time. And we're kind of currently in this weird, not argument, but we've got this dilemma where in theory, you have to register the child with the government and because the child doesn't exist. So her name's Aurora, same you know, weight and length and everything like that. It's the same kind of health situation. Everything's going well, but not.
What do you mean register it? What do you mean register the child? What does that mean?
So when a baby is born in the hospital, yeah. So we can't get a birth certificate until we register the child with the birth department, and that's normally done at the hospital. But if you have a home birth, usually you have a midwife or a doula, some sort of medical professional. And they do the paperwork for you because they're the medical professionals. So they can sign off and say, we can confirm, in fact, that this is a baby and that this person had a baby. But at the current point we're at, we have a baby in the house that's not registered. We have an unregistered, I'm carrying an unregistered baby at the moment. And this is not a registered baby. Technically, we could have kidnapped this baby. This baby doesn't exist on paper. There's no proof other than my word to say that this baby was in fact.
It's going to be the next raid, Thomas. The cops are going to kick down your door and go, you're under arrest for unregistered baby.
Yeah. Unlikely, but yeah, it's kind of funny. But Victoria is better than the other states because you can just do like a stat deck and you just do a bit of extra paperwork. Whereas the other states, it gets a bit complicated. You have to have like someone, like I think you have to have a GP or a chiropractor or something like that confirm it. So yeah, so it's interesting. Everything's going well. Another girl. All right, two down, about eight to go. So
awesome news. Love it. News.
More white babies.
Yeah, good quality too.
Good quality. But I wanted to, before we move on to the next subject, I wanted to respond to Wolfie Doofy, right? He says here, it's far better that Israel loses than Palestine. That's reason enough to support Palestine now in this fight. It's to our benefit. Doesn't mean we have to feel sympathy, just being strategic. This is my response to that. Obviously, we're against the Jews, but we're also against the Muslims. We have more than one enemy. So until the Muslims get the fuck out of my country, I'm not too worried about defending their countries. That's the deal. That's like basic 101. Now, I think we should go against like our governments, particularly the American government, providing support to Israel, don't want to fight wars for Israel, want to deny them our blood, our treasure. But that's the extent of it. But it should be done on the basis of what's good for us, that their fight isn't our fight. We have nothing to do with it. We get no benefit from it. They are parasites. They occupy positions of power and influence in our political system as parasites to extract resources from us, and they actively sabotage us. We should be framing it in terms of whites versus Jews. We shouldn't be framing it in terms of Palestine versus Israel, or Muslims versus Israel, or everyone versus Israel. There's a problem in this movement where there's people that put counter-Semitism or being against the Jews politically above being pro-white. And that's us backwards. The reason why we are against Jews is because we are whites and the Jews have attacked us as a people, as a race. We're defending our race against them. They are our racial enemies. There's no inherent reason to be against Jews if you don't have a loyalty anywhere. Like, why would you? And the only loyalty you could have then would be to some kind of abstract humanity. And then you're in the egalitarian humanitarianism of the left, of the political left, which is the ideology that most whites believe in, whether by default or more consciously, that is responsible for what is happening to our race, that is facilitating Jewish, Muslim, and other, you know, other non-white attacks on our people. We can't stand up as a race against the Jews or against any other group until we correct that first. So we have to stop using that egalitarian framework, that humanitarian framework, and we need to start using a pro-white framework, a racial loyalist framework to understand politics. And we need to demonstrate that to the people. That is what is most strategically important, because that's our only salvation. So you can say, fuck Israel. I don't have a problem with that, but I'm not waving a Palestinian flag. That's cucked. They aren't my people. They've done nothing for me. I don't have any business in doing anything for them. And it's fundamentally cucked to put the flag of the Palestinians in your avatar instead of the flag of your own nation. It's fundamentally cucked to be out in the street protesting on behalf of Palestinian rights when your rights are being trampled on in your own country. And you're not protesting in defense of those. So you just have it wrong. You just have it backwards. But that doesn't mean that we take one iota of animosity or antagonism away from the Jews. The Jews are our racial enemy. And we talk about the Jews openly and we put pressure on the Jews openly. There aren't anti-Semites in Australia that the Jews fear more than probably the three of us on this show right now, frankly. Like when the when the Executive Council of Australian Jewry does its end of year reports on anti-Semitism, they have whole sections, Blair Cottrell, Thomas Sewell, Joel Davis, and then all the other sections are basically all of our friends. That's literally what it is. If you can look it up, they'll do another one this probably for last year. Someone will probably send it to me and be like, oh, Joel, here's your section. Look at Tom's section. And we'll all like see who gets the most pages. And, you know, whoever gets the most pages, like, I guess we'll throw them a party or something because it's funny. Like, that's the reality. So, yeah, it's about fundamentally being loyal to your own people first and foremost. And then everything comes from that. Everything is rooted in that fundamental principle. And when you strategically trade that away for any temporary strategic benefit, you are confusing the whites that you're trying to bring into the correct mindset. If you want whites to think like you, you have to express your thoughts clearly. If you express your thoughts through like strategic innuendo and convolution and misdirection, then you are teaching whites around you to think in that way, as opposed to the way that you actually think. So that is always going to be worse than just being authentic and real and true to your principles.
I might leave you guys to it. I've got like a cracking migraine because I was doing a lot of work on the computer today. Yeah.
Before you go, we gotta watch this Hitler speech video.
Okay. I've probably seen it before.
About the BBC thing.
I used to watch these videos like, oh man, religiously. Yeah, it'd be 19.
Yeah. But are we not going to talk about the BBC thing, Blair?
Oh, yeah. There's a British Broadcasting Corporation investigation currently happening regarding me, but not specifically regarding me. It's more about taking down Mark Collett and Patriotic Alternative taking down. I don't really know what I mean by that. I know that it's just a bit of a slander effort, I suppose. They're trying to blame anything racist that's ever happened in the history of England on Mark Collett and the Patriotic Alternative crew there. Apparently, while I was in England, I may have been, while in conversation with some people at the Patriotic Alternative conference, secretly recorded by a spy, because the British Broadcasting Corporation, namely Jane Morgan, a producer there, an investigative journalist, as she calls herself, she's accused me of saying what she describes as violent or racist things against black people. She won't tell me what those things are, though. I keep replying to her email. This is the document that she sent me here. She claims to have evidence that I've said racist things against black people in private conversation, which I thought was pretty funny. It's like, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone saying anything that isn't racist in a private conversation when they don't know they're being secretly recorded. But it's like a big expose, right? Like Blair Cottrell, famous Australian racist, says racist things in private conversation. Who would have thought? But I just replied to her email. I was like, what have you got? Like, what's the actual evidence? Let me know what it is. And if you don't want to show me the evidence, then just explain what the evidence is and provide a full transcript of the conversation, including remarks and questions made by participants in the conversation. Then I'll be able to comment on the allegations, because I don't actually know what she's talking about specifically. But she won't give me any evidence. She's just like, do you deny it? We're not going to show you the evidence, but do you deny it? And I just said, hey, jump on a Zoom call with me. I recorded a Zoom call. That was the last email I sent her. And I said, we'll talk about it. You can show me the evidence on a Zoom call and get a live response and reaction from me. It's good for your production, I think. Should be easy enough for a prestigious investigative journalist like Jane Morgan from the British Broadcasting Corporation. I'm just a racist, working class racist, without any education. Should be really easy for her, right? But she hasn't responded yet. It's been 2 days. If she's got a clever production team, they'll tell her not to do it. But I think she's smart enough to handle herself. I think she can do it. I'd like to think that she has the confidence as a seasoned investigative journalist to actually present the evidence to me fairly, as any realistically reasonable journalist would do. So hopefully that happens. But look, there's this is basically what's happening, right? While all this grooming gang stuff's going on, while Elon's bringing it to light on X, while all of these politicians are being implicated and have been discovered to be involved somewhat in covering it up, police bureaucrats involved, et cetera, what the British Broadcasting Corporation, government-funded media, is doing while all of that's happening is sending spies out to private functions and barbecues to try to secretly record people saying racist things. That's where government media resources are going while all of that's happening at political level with the grooming gangs. It's like, so are you even surprised?
Well, I'm looking for, I hope they have a recording, because I'm looking forward to hearing it, because I'm sure it's funny, whatever you said. And that's the thing. When you told me about this, I said the real controversy would be if you said something that wasn't racist, everyone would be like, oh, Blair's a cuck.
Like at first she's like, oh, we have evidence of saying something. I'm like, shit, what did I say? If I said something if it was uncovered that I actually wasn't racist in secret, well, that would be more damning to me. But, I don't know what she has. It's weird. Racism, it's weird. It's a weird. Yeah. See, down here in Australia, when you accuse someone of something, you produce the evidence or you don't have a case. I don't know how things work up there in England, but I'm being accused of something, but then the evidence is being denied to me and I'm still being asked for a comment while the evidence is being denied to me. That's strange. That's Orwellian shit. We don't do that down here in Australia. I'm not used to that. So hopefully she shows me what she's got. Hopefully she jumps on a Zoom call with me to show me what she's got, because I'd be keen to see it and react to it. Ask her a few questions while I'm there.
Yes.
What do you reckon, Sam?
Yeah, I think it's going to be good.
Because you guys had a spy with a recording device come to a few events at some point, didn't you?
Yeah. I've had plenty of experiences that like what you're talking about reminds me of three experiences I've had. One, the one you're talking about right now, the infiltrator to the org that secretly filmed everyone. The other was when I got fired from the Catholic charity I worked at, you know, in relation to child protection. I got fired for being a racist, but they didn't call me a racist. They said that I was dishonest. And I said, okay, can you provide in writing where I've been dishonest? and they wouldn't provide any evidence. They wouldn't provide it in writing. And so the meeting was really strange because I was like, can you provide in writing where I've been dishonest? And they couldn't do it. And they basically were saying like, do you admit that you've been dishonest? And it's like, whoa. So I've dealt with these exact, I know exactly the kind of human being you're dealing with. It was a really strange conversation. And then and there was a third thing that it reminded me of, but it skipped my mind. Oh, sorry. When the Dance Monkey incident happened, where I went, like they were calling us terrorists. And so I went down to Channel 9 to say to them, like, we're not terrorists. Like, I'll explain to you in front of your cameras, like just interview me for like 10 minutes and I'll explain what we're doing and why. And they refused to speak to me. They just ran their smear campaign. And then obviously the incident happened with the security guard and I bashed him. And then afterwards, they then interviewed me later, like over Zoom. So they did like an interview. I remember sitting on the laptop in like the living room and I was talking to the journalist through the laptop. And then that wasn't live, but that was put on A Current Affair like an hour later. And, I remember him saying, like me saying to him, why didn't you interview me? Like, why didn't you just speak to me then before any of this happened? And they were like, oh, well, we're speaking to you now. It's like, well, you're speaking to me now because I bashed an African. You're not speaking to me like when you were just randomly calling me a terrorist when like we haven't done anything wrong. We're just like advocating for white people. And then you had your security guard attack us. And so, yeah, what do I think about that situation? I think you'll be fine. I think it'll look good. There were the only people that freak out in these situations. Do you remember a guy called Vinny? Tall, handsome blonde guy called Vinny in the org in the lads.
Oh, I don't know. We've had a few tall, handsome blonde guys. You'll have to be more specific.
That's true. He got secretly recorded in that 60 Minutes interview saying that like one of his family members or one of his friends got carjacked by Africans and they were roaming the streets in Croydon. There was an incident where we actually responded up in Croydon to some carjackings where Africans were running riot up there that weren't even from the area. They'd caught the train in. And we like mobilized like a UPF, like a militia task force to deal with these Africans running around with machetes. And like 20 guys rocked up in like 45 minutes, which was pretty cool because we're all on different sides of town. And then I remember he was telling a similar story to the expose crew. And he was saying something like, oh, that he got his axe and he was ready. Like this, you know, some Africans tried to carjack him or his family member and he had the axe and he was ready to deal with it. And that was put on national television, like he's the most horrible racist in Australia and that he's a terrorist. And it's like every single Aussie watching that is like, what a sick cunt. So he actually was willing to defend the people he loves. So he's actually a true blue Aussie ocker fella. And his whole family were just like torturing him over it. Like, this looks so bad. You look horrible. And like all these women got in his ear and all these women, like the misses and the sisters and the mom and everyone just got in his ear and it just made him cave. And I think back, like if you just spoke to any bloke at work, oh, how did I come across? They would have been like, yeah, you seemed like a sick cunt. Like it just shows that you're all just good, normal Aussie blokes. And there was another guy that got interviewed and he was saying like that he grew up and he was just surrounded by Africans and they were a serious problem and he doesn't want that for his children. And like he didn't cave, but like his comments were just as reasonable, but he was more of like a kind of intelligent, well-spoken guy versus like a working class Aussie guy. And so both of these characters came across really well. And so what A Current Affair did, or sorry, 60 Minutes did, was they just put like dark, gloomy music over the top of it. And then that's how they emotionally manipulate the public into thinking that these comments are bad, but these comments are objectively good and the majority agree with them. So I think it'll be fine. I think it'll be good. And considering that I don't think many people watch these crappy things anyway that are way politically inclined in the first place. But anyone that's potentially on the fence and then seeing what's going on with the mass rape of white people and then some Australians come up to Britain and he's doing a speech and he says something in passing about it that he doesn't like black people, that he thinks black people aren't that nice. I think that's probably going to go down okay with the average joker.
I've never been in a situation with the press, a journalist, some TV, radio program, where I haven't made it work to my advantage. So exactly. I'm pretty confident I'll be able to do the same, yeah.
Yeah. And but, you're just like the archetype of this Australian Chad. You know what I mean? Like the English people will love you. The English people will be like, well, hang on a minute. So this Australian Chad just came back to the motherland. And then he's like, yeah, black people are a problem. Yeah, you got to fix that, eh, don't you, guys? Like, anyway, I'm done with the holidays. See you later. Bye. I'm going back to Australia. Like, they'll love, like, who's going to dislike that? People that already hate us and want white
people. Oh, I'm not worried for a moment. Like, compared to some of the other stuff I've had to deal with during my political campaign, this is kind of small stuff. I think it's something that happened in another country. The evidence is hearsay. Yeah. And it probably was just something that's going to be funny when you hear it on camera or audio recording anyway. Like, most people would probably just laugh at it or agree with it. I'm not the kind of guy that says stuff that's like, really extreme. Even in private conversation, you don't really get me saying any edgy shit. I'm usually like pretty practical in conversation, but not because I'm scared, just because, you know, I don't really see any point venting.
You're an aristocratic racist. You're not very sort casually racist. Most people are quite casually racist. You're probably one of the least casually racist people I know.
Yeah, it's funny. I've always said that too. I've said it a few times on stream that despite my reputation, like I'm one of the least racist compared to the boys. Like I've got this like horrible reputation. Like, I'm one of the more reasonable ones. But speaking of Australia, there's an Australia Day event taking place hosted by Matt Trye on Sunday, the 26th. 26th of January. I'll be attending that, and I'll be doing a bit of promotion for that in the next couple of weeks leading up to the day. And I haven't really promoted something directly. I haven't put my name to something in a few years, but Matt Trye, I know him to be a good guy. He's an honorable man. He's a good builder. I've worked for him. I know this guy, and he's putting himself out there and he's having a crack. He wants to reinvigorate some national pride. Certain aspects of the Australian government don't want to recognize Australia Day because of colonialism and Aboriginals and so forth, but he wants to recognize it publicly. He wants to be loud and proud. So I'm going to be giving him my support this Australia Day this year, and I hope everyone watching this will do the same. But, yeah, you can find out more about that through me and various other channels. I'm sure we'll be talking about it too in the next week or two.
Awesome. All right, well, let's watch this video before you log off.
Yeah,
That's all right. My headache's going away now. I don't know what it is. I'm just starting to get migraines behind my eye on the left side.
Probably the
I don't usually light. Get them. Maybe, yeah. Okay. I just do shine a light. Yeah.
Let's go.
Guten Morgen, wenn dieses ganze deutsche Volk zu so einer einzigen Opfergemeinschaft wird, dann allein können wir auch erwarten. Da können wir hoffen, dass uns die Vorsehung auch in der Zukunft wieder beistehen wird. Der Herrgott hat noch niemals einem Faulen geholfen. Er hilft auf keinem Feigen. Er hilft auf keinem Volk, das sich nicht selber helfen will. Wir gelten größten der Grundsatz. Volk hilft dir selbst, dann wird der Herrgott seine Hilfe dir nicht verweigern.
I remember those clips, and they would just motivate me so much. When I started to understand what the symbol on those banners truly meant and what this guy believed in, what this guy represented, God, the sort of motivation stuff like that would give me back in the day, you know, behind the scenes, that's the sort of stuff I was watching all the time. And you could watch that stuff on YouTube. It was like there was millions of views of these speeches on YouTube. It was so popular. And then during the great crackdown, I think it was around 2016, all of this stuff got nuked, and you've got to sort of do some digging to find it now. But yeah, brings back some memories seeing that.
The AI translations of the Hitler speeches are getting better and better. More and more is getting translated. I've been seeing a few accounts out there that are putting in great work, and I'm seeing them pop up on YouTube, and they're going crazy. Obviously, they went crazy on TikTok. I think they tried to change the algorithms to stop them from going insanely viral because they were just too viral. But I think we've got a new wave of Hitler speeches where people can listen to them in English because they've been AI kind of adjusted. So I'm excited to see the ramifications of that. You know, you call it AI, whatever you want to call it, whether it's, you know, I don't want to get into a philosophical discussion on whether AI is like a legitimate description of the programming.
When you consider, Joel, when you consider the fact that Hitler's German words are run through an artificial intelligence program where his emotions aren't really accurately translated. They're only emulated somewhat. They're only kind of copied in an English-sounding voice. But what he's saying resonates so much with the viewer, with the person who's watching it, that it doesn't matter that the emotion has been kind of put through an AI filter and it's not real. It's good enough for the person to be like, wow, we need someone like this today. You know, it's that impactful.
Yes. Well, some of the ones that have been done, I'm not going to say it preserves the exact same emotion as the original, but it has good emotion in the voice. Like the guys that are doing it, they're using like, they're also using some of the better software and they know what they're doing and they're doing a good job. Some of the stuff that I've heard. So, and it's only just beginning. Like imagine how much better it will be in 2 years or 3 years as the technology just keeps getting better and better. So I'm looking forward to, yeah, the new AI Hitler speech paradigm. And
we'll have to just keep glazing Elon. I have to keep glazing Musk so he develops better tech for higher quality Hitler translations.
Yeah, well, I don't think people are really using his tech to do it, but yeah. Yeah, I'm looking forward to the BBC clip of you roasting Negroes. That should make for some viral content.
Like I said, though, Joel, it's not all about me. They're including me in a larger story, which seems to be about Patriotic Alternative, Mark Collett. Mm. Mark told me that a lot of people have received emails, so it's part of like a big maybe 20-25 minute segment, which is supposed to be this big expose and is trying to blame various examples of racism and prejudice all on Patriotic Alternative to make it seem like Mark Collett is the mastermind behind it all. That seems to be what the program is about. So it'll be funny. Like, so for people like us who actually know Mark, it'll be funny.
Yeah, I mean, I wish that they did that when I was there. I would have liked to get a BBC clip of me saying some racist shit, but, you know, hopefully next time, I don't know.
I don't know what happens, man. Just controversy. I was in the country for, 9 or 10 days? And in that short period, someone managed to, like, secretly record or film me saying some stuff. So, I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, well, I'm keen. You should make a, when you finish this correspondence with this journalist, hopefully you make something you should make a video or something about it. I think you were saying you were going to do something like that. You know, get out ahead of it and, give your take on it all. But yeah, I'm keen to see the actual footage, on the BBC. It's always funny seeing the boys on television. They put this show on television on the ABC a few months ago. That was pretty funny. We never actually talked about it on the show for some bizarre reason.
It's going to be funny. It's going to be funny because my speech.
I think I got arrested two or three times and raided and lost all my tech. And I think I didn't come on the show for like 3 weeks because I didn't have a laptop on two occasions. Like they took like three laptops and that's why we never covered it. But I remember the Home Affairs Minister was saying that we were un-Australian. Yeah, because we were protesting Indians that were demanding to stay in the country when they're not Australians. And we were not Australian for not wanting Indians that aren't Australian to stay in the country, even though they currently aren't allowed to stay in the country because they're not Australians. That was pretty funny.
Yeah, my favorite Jew on Twitter, who I don't know why he hasn't blocked me.
He loves it. He's never going to. He's like Dravir. They're like vampires.
Menachem Vorsheimer.
Yes.
What a name. He made a tweet today and a video talking about how real Australians aren't racist or anti-Semites. And I just let him know that he's a Jew. Who the fuck is he to tell me? But of course, it's ridiculous. Like the people who created Australia were all fucking racists.
Yeah, I think you'll find racism is a pretty natural, intrinsic thing for everybody. It's like everyone is actually racist. Probably white people are the least racist, and that's a problem. We need to be more racist. Racism is a very natural thing. And I think, exactly. And the Jews are significantly more racist than us, and they owe a lot of their successes in our country to that fact. So the sooner that we can work that out as a people, the sooner people like us can convince white Australians of that fact, I think, the better.
Yeah, well, the thing is, when we built this country, we built it with racism. Like, racism was the founding idea of Australia and of most countries, frankly, but it was very explicit. Like, probably more explicit than the founding of any country ever, was racism the reason why Australia came into existence?
Yeah, Alfred Deakin. The most racist
founding of a country ever.
Alfred Deakin in 1901 They were even talking about mass deportations, even though there were, like, by today's standards, hardly any foreigners in Australia. There was still enough to really annoy the white Australians of back then in 1901.
Didn't talk about it.
After Australia was federated, the Attorney General at the time, Alfred Deakin, gave a speech specifically saying that the Immigration Restriction Act wasn't just about keeping Australia white, wasn't just about stopping immigrants from coming in the future. It was about actually deporting the people in Australia who weren't white up until that point as well. So even like mass deportations was a thing back then.
Of course. And Alfred Deakin, he became prime minister. He was Australia's second prime minister. And he, if anyone could be considered a founding father of the Australian Federation, he would be the top of the list. He's like our Thomas Jefferson. And he said Australia is an Aryan nation. He literally used the word Aryan.
Is Deakin University named after him?
We're about securing this continent for the white race. Like, he was super racist, you know? Like, he was literally as racist as us.
Deakin University is named after him, right? God, if only he could see what his, if only he could see what his name was being used for in those institutions these days.
Something that's a little bit left of field that I was just reminded of. Well, not really left of field, but kind of a synchronicity. The UK government just froze all the assets of Blood and Honour. And I saw that in the news recently. I think it was like 2 days ago. While they were going to their vote, they've gone and I think they even might have registered Blood and Honour as a prescribed group. And for those that don't know, Blood and Honour, the name of this episode of the show and also the motto for our movement, is also a sort of skinhead 1.0 white nationalist band clique kind of group from the UK. They did have a branch here in Australia a long time ago that I think they might still have beers together, but I don't think they're organized anymore. But Blood and Honour was just part of the greater scene, like Rock Against Communism and the 1.0s, that whole working class skinhead scene. So it's interesting. They don't actually do anything anymore. They're mostly just older guys and it's more of a social club. But it's interesting that in the middle of a grooming gang scandal where all these politicians need to be investigated, instead of investigating themselves or not like that would happen, they are going after a more or less a semi-defunct 1990s Rock Against Communism sort of support group. So, yeah, and it reminds me of when they did the inquiry into, you know, radical extremism on the right, the Senate inquiry. They didn't ban us, they didn't ban our organization, but they banned something called Sonnenkrieg Division, which is like a, you know, so people might think, oh, geez, that there's a right-wing group that's been banned. Well, it's not a real group. Sonnenkrieg Division was like a Discord server with a bunch of like 16-year-old gamers on it, and they would meme about the Jews and the Nazis, and that they would make memes about it, and the government thought like it was a real organization, or they don't think it's a real organization. They just wanted to get one on the board saying, hey, look, we banned a right-wing group as well. So the government looks like the government's banned two groups now, two right-wing groups. One of them, a Discord server full of Zoomers that play video games, that's registered as banned. And another one, which is like a kind of defunct supporters group for like a music band from the 90s. So, yeah, win British police. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they like were denying them financial services or something, like trying to shut down their bank accounts or something like that.
Yeah,
but like not just shut down their bank accounts, but like make it illegal for like the org, like people in the org to use financial services. Period.
Yes.
Yeah, but anyway, like as you said, I mean, I don't really know on the ground what's going on in Britain. How many people are affected or whatever, and feel sorry for anyone who is affected. But as you said, I don't think that they're particularly active anymore. So it is a bizarre move. But as you say, then the left-wing journalists, they can be like, oh, look at all these right-wing extremist groups that have been listed as terrorists. That shows that like right-wing extremism is a real terrorist problem. And so it becomes like this circular logic where they ban groups that aren't terrorists to prove that they're a right-wing terrorists. Yeah.
All right, I'm gonna head off. I'm gonna try to get a good night's sleep.
Me too. I've got a jet. This headache's coming back a bit, but thanks guys for staying with us. And I'll see you next week. As long as we hit it off next week, we usually go Thursday nights, but this week was Friday night, but we still got it in. Are you going to do super chats, Joel?
Yeah, there's a few super chats.
I'm going to sign off. Blood and honor.
See ya.
See you, mate.
Blood and honor.
Joel, stick around and Joel will do the super chats, guys, and I'll see you all next week.
Callum, a supporter, just says, some people really think Muslim hate is some sort of a Jewish ploy. Maybe America is not offended as affected by Muslims as Europe or Australia. Well, yeah, exactly. Like, I think, and by Muslims, we mean like Arabs and Pakis and things like that. We're not talking about Indonesians, but like these Browns, these Muslim Browns, they're the most hated group of any group in Europe and probably in Australia as well, even though they aren't as prominent here as they are in a lot of Western European countries. You don't need Jewish propaganda to get white people to hate Muslims. They just fucking hate them naturally. Remember there was a study that came out around 2017, I believe, give or take, in Australia, saying should we ban all Islamic immigration into Australia? And the majority of people said yes. And if you look at it breakdown by party affiliation, it was like a third of Greens voters were saying yes, and like 40% of Labour voters. Like these are left-wing voters. So even a very substantial, like over a third of left-wing voters supported banning Muslims from Australia, let alone the right, obviously big majorities of the right-wing voters supported it. So Islamic immigration is not popular. Islam is not popular. Muslims are not popular. So it doesn't take Jewish propaganda to make us hate them. Living near them is all you need. And that doesn't mean that we support wars in the Middle East for Israel. Those are unpopular. We don't want them in our fucking countries. So yeah. And the crime, as I said, like the crimes that they've committed in Europe is just insane. Like even as from an Australian perspective, it's really hard to like things have happened here that have been horrible, but not at that scale. Emma Down Under says, popping in to say hi to our warriors. We appreciate you. And she also congratulated Tom on his baby. So thanks for that. On Entropy, based Henry George said, once again, in the news, there is talk, whether serious or not, of Trump's desire to annex Canada. Many on the right have been critical of the idea, but as an American, I realize there could be risk to it. But I think it could be a net positive for the cause. Can you guys share your opinions on this? Great show last week with you, Blair and Jacob. I thought Blair was in particularly fine form. Thanks. Yeah, so, you know, the Canadians might not like this, but I don't think it's going to, I don't think annexation of Canada is going to happen, but I don't think it would necessarily be the worst thing in the world. It would provide the Canadians with better protections for their, for free speech, for their gun rights. I think it would be easier for Canadian pro-whites to organize under the jurisdiction of the American government than the current government in Canada. The situation remains the same, like, radical change is necessary. So the continuation of the current like Canadian government or American government in its current form like is not going to be sufficient for white people. We need radical change. So if they do a change like that, it's like, well, we want to do revolutionary change anyway. It doesn't have to be permanent. But also what that would do is I think also slow down the amount of immigrants going into the Canadian region, because Canada has way higher immigration per capita than America. So if they just became part of America, they just have one immigration policy, the majority of those immigrants would just go to like what is currently the United States. Not that many of them would go to Canada. So I think it would slow down white replacement in Canada. So I think, you know, from a practical standpoint, it wouldn't be the worst thing. That doesn't say that we should be supporting it. Just if it was to happen, I don't think it would be the end of the world either. I don't think it's like it could provide some strategic advantages, but I don't think we should be supporting it either. But yeah, I know a lot of Canadians might feel angry about it, but it seems like a meme, like preserving current so-called Canadian sovereignty is a joke anyway. Like Canada is basically run by America, or the same people that run America, the same, you know, Jewish interests, financial interests, globalist interests. So what really is the difference? Yeah. So that's my take on it. Canadians might get upset, but you know, whatever. I don't think it'll happen anyway. It's kind of like a tangential issue. it's something that I think Trump is talking about to kind of rile up the patriotards, like, like, fuck you, Canada, and like get a little like dumb boomer support. But I don't think it's a serious idea in any meaningful sense. Racist aristocrat said, aristocratic radicalism between corrupt egalitarian democracy and the materialist socialism of the mob. Racist aristocratic anti-Semitism, not Christian anti-Semitism. We are not the last of yesterday, but the first of tomorrow. Yeah, I think it's important that we articulate our criticism of the Jews in terms of a racial loyalist standpoint, and also from the standpoint of like a Jewish degradation of our culture. It's not just in the sense of them attacking our race in the most direct sense of like mass immigration and things like that, but also Jewish influence, like through Hollywood movies, spreading degenerate ideas, spreading things that are spiritually debilitating to Aryans, because Jews are of a different spirit that is fundamentally corrupting. So anti-Semitism is deeper than just being against Jews politically. I think you have to be against Jews culturally, or Jewishness, you know, in general. Racist aristocrat also said, if we manage to repair the damage of capitalist environmental destruction, it will mean nothing if we have fallen into racial degeneracy. It is genetic pollution, the hazardous dumps of our cities, which threatens to destroy all higher civilization. Yes, well, I'm just going to take that as a comment. That is obviously true. And I'm going to end the stream there and wish you all a good evening. Thanks for watching the show. We'll be back next week. Maybe we'll be back on Thursday night next week, but we'll let you know. Follow us on social media. And if you need to reach out to me, I'm pretty available on social media. If you are in Australia, you want to get involved, message me, message Tom, get involved. I say this almost every week. Also, I want to also say, just before we close, I really appreciate all the clippers. There's some people out there that do a great job clipping the show, doing a nice edit on it sometimes, and then distributing it on other platforms. If you want to help and you're willing to either learn how to be okay with video editing software, which isn't that complicated, or you already know your way around with that kind of stuff, that's a concrete way that you can help. Little bite-sized clips of the show, if you pick good segments and you make a nice edit of them and you put them on other social media platforms, they can go very viral. You know, clips from the show last week went viral as fuck, mostly because Indians were seething about things that I said. But clips from the show last week got millions of views. So clips can get way more views than the show itself. And clips go viral all the time from the show. So the work that you guys do, clipping, is great. If you see clips on Twitter or something, retweet them. But also go on other platforms. Facebook and Instagram seem to be relaxing their censorship policies at the moment. So throw our clips up on there. TikTok is always fantastic. You can get crazy views on there. Put them on TikTok in particular. I really would appreciate it because Blair's banned from TikTok. I know when I make a TikTok, it will get banned pretty quickly. So I was kind of saving it for like a time where I wanted to kind of burn my official Joel Davis TikTok account, where I get like 1 week on TikTok. So I was waiting for, I'm just still waiting, keeping that in my back pocket to deploy on a particular issue that I want to go hard on TikToks with. So I'm just saving that because once you get banned, if you make an official account, they just ban you for ban evasion. But unofficial accounts can post clips of us that go viral, and they do it all the time. So I encourage you all, if you're a clipper, not just clips of this show, but clips of other things that Tom or myself or Blair or Jacob do. Obviously, Jacob puts out a lot of short form content himself, and reposting that is always great. But, you know, if we go on Twitter spaces, if we do guest interviews, whatever, I really appreciate the work that clippers do. And, you know, as I said, that's like, we get way, way bigger views on clips than we do on the streams themselves. That's the nature of the internet. So that's viral content, short form content. So that's a way that you could, if you could consider, you want to help out and you have the time to learn how to do that kind of thing and get good at it. We really need people that are good at social media. We need people that are going to commit to social media promotion, building up accounts on X, on Instagram, on TikTok in particular, those three platforms. But building up accounts on there, or even you can go on YouTube and put clips on YouTube and see how that goes. But we need people to get good at these platforms, help amplify our messaging, help promote our worldview, not just clips of us, but just general nationalist content. I feel like Australians, we don't do that well enough. I feel like I see a lot better work done in that area by our American and European friends. So we need to level up. So that's something that you guys can consider out there. A lot of times, for example, women, they'll say, what can I do to help? Because getting involved IRL is a bit harder if you're a woman. Well, that's one way. But also younger guys, maybe you're at university and you want to become a lawyer or something like that. You don't want to get doxxed or whatever the case may be. You're a younger guy. You're too young to get involved. Well, here's something you can do. So please consider, please consider clipping the show and becoming an effective social media propagandist. I see a lot of people on social media who are just kind of consumers. They don't treat it as a vector for activism. And that's fine if you don't have much time. But if you have the time, rather than just sitting there doom scrolling all day, become active and actually do something productive with your social media, you know, time. So it's not just like time that's being flushed unproductively. Get productive and help advance the worldview. So I'm just going to say that at the end of the show, and I hope you guys enjoy the rest of your evening, and we'll see you all next week.